This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue for my comic book collection, which I selected based on a secret theme. Any comic book in my collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 204th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we are looking at Ms. Tree number 9 from Eclipse Comics, cover dated June 1984. But first, a little feedback. And we start with feedback from me. Well, not so much feedback, I guess, as updates. And I have updates on the past two episodes. Back in episode 202, we covered the first issue of Sword. At the time, I actually picked up the first two issues of Sword from Half Price Books and put them both in the podcast database. But after reading that first one, which just barely crossed the sure it's worth 25 cents threshold, I decided to do two things. One, I removed issue 2 from the database, as I didn't feel the need to give another issue from that title the full treatment on the show. And two, I decided to give it a read. Then and there, ripped the Band-Aid off. And the second issue of Sword? No, dog, not for me. What really struck me was how different, how disconnected issue 1 seemed from issue 2 plot-wise. Yes, the setting was the same, and many of the characters were the same, but it seemed like part of a totally different story. Remember that one of the questions that Dr. Ange had about the issue was, where would it go next? What would ongoing issues be like? And issue 2 really answered none of those questions. And then I made the fateful mistake. I looked up the books from this era of X-Men, being the Reign of X era, and I noticed that Sword 1 and Sword 2 were 10 issues apart from each other. In other words, there were 9 other comics continuing the story between issues 1 and 2. We had issues of Marauders, New Mutants, X-Force, Excalibur, X-Men, Wolverine, X-Factor, Hellions, and then another issue of Marauders. So of course the two issues seemed disconnected, because only a moron would buy these two issues and think that one followed the other directly just because the issue number of one followed directly the issue number of the other. But then I asked myself, Professor, if you had this reading order with you and actually found those 9 in-between issues in a cheap bin, a quarter bin even, would you purchase and read them? And I'm going to have to be honest. Nah, dog. And then from last episode, episode 203, I just kept reading the Patsy Walker trade, knocking out issues 2 through 6. And I'm going to say it continued to be a light, fun, delightful read. And here, we may be running into one of the glories of this podcast, because I'm not saying, and I have never said, that any particular issue that I cover on this show is worth its full cover price, especially if it's a recent book, and that cover price is in the neighborhood of $4 or $5. I'm not saying I'd be as delighted with Hellcat if I'd bought the issues off the stands when they were new, paying that price. But at a quarter? Or in a trade from the public library or the Hoopla digital app, where cost is literally not an issue? I found these light, breezy reads to be well worth what I paid, because all I paid for issues 2 through 6 was time and attention. In those following issues, we did get some silliness, and we did get a unique art choice in one issue. We also got some adventure and some plot and some legal shenanigans, because She-Hulk is awesome. That entire first trade, Hooked on a Feline, was a fun read start to finish. Now, speaking of Patsy Walker number one, our great buddy Billy D was not amused, at least judging from all the GIFs that he posted while listening to the episode. But he did note one positive aspect about last episode. Thank Crom, you're covering something from the 80s next time. I think I'll set my Odin sleep reminder for the next time you stray past that decade. Yeah, Billy, you might just want to skip the very end of this episode where I announce what we're doing next time. But that aside, I truly hope you thoroughly enjoy this 80s-tastic episode. I promise that I'll talk slowly and drag this entire episode out, so you can spend as much time as possible here in the 80s. Even Ranger Gord had reservations about the episode. I was about to post another devastating screed about this not being a Doctor Doom comic, but then I came to my senses. I realized that if this is set in a bookstore, there would be vast troves of material about Lord Victor in the biography and European history sections, Latverian travel books, robotics textbooks, time travel, and of course, comics that we know for years have hid his glorious visage behind other covers. Therefore, I can only conclude that Hellcat is a Doctor Doom comic. Very clever hidden message, Professor. Oh, and hail Doom. Well, Gord, you cracked the code. You got me. And a hearty hail Doom to you, friend. Fortunately, Sir Iowa's Joe had a more positive, albeit brief, take on the issue. I always liked Kate Leth's take. See? Now that is the right answer. And Sir, Dr. Ange had things to say as well. Interesting comic to bring attention to. I didn't get this one. Wholeheartedly agree that this does just what a number one is supposed to do. You know, the theme, the cast, and a subplot. More than enough to bring you back if it clicks. Also, I think this would not click for me. These days, I mostly read comics for escapism and entertainment, and I probably have room for maybe one title of whimsy, slice-of-life adventures. One thing that I think has happened is that there is a glut of whimsical slice-of-life comics on the racks these days, both back in 2016, like you said, and still now. And I don't know if the market can sustain more of this type than others. I also think it waters down the genre a little when there are so many titles with that similar feel. Me, I tend to give She-Hulk a long leash because I love Jen, but that means I probably won't buy any others. Perhaps worse is when comics can't commit and do a hodgepodge of slice of life and traditional adventure. This isn't going to help anyone. The recent Supergirl special spent a lot of time showing how alone she feels and how she eats cupcakes. But an introspective issue is okay in a monthly title now and then, but a special? Anyway, this is rambling. I always say, if you like a comic, I'm happy for you. Happy comic fans, buy more comics and keep the comic market working. Glad you liked it. I'm glad I liked it too, Doc. Yeah, it was a change of pace episode discussing a change of pace comic book. Fortunately, Sir Martin had my back. What a lovely choice for an episode. I like this series a lot. I see the Squirrel Girl vibe, but I quickly jumped off. I think it was the annoying cute lines at the bottom of every page. Oh, Mart, that was one of my favorite bits about Squirrel Girl. But Patsy Walker was more my cup of tea. There were some great supporting characters, and Patsy is always a hoot. This issue deftly used Patsy's convoluted continuity to set up something new, and succeeding issues lived up to the promise. I recommend a read on the Marvel app if anyone missed it. And I second Mart's recommendation. Social media love for last episode came from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Chris from Professor Frenzy, it's a show. Sir Luke, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Bill from the Bat Pod, Aaron Henley, Chris Lydon 7, Jay Campbell, James from Karen, Shane Kelly, Gregory Litchfield, Trevor Owen Williams, Al Sedano, Derek WC, Chris Willett, The Telltale Mind, Keith G. Baker, Stephen E. Shend, Ed Moore, The Newsprint Commando, and Clinton from the Days of High Adventure podcast. Thank you all. Comments and support are appreciated. Which means it's time to take a break, play a podcast promo, and when we come back, it'll be time for a Miz Tree.
To confront the ultimate killers, I must construct the ultimate alias.
Hey, who is that lady? I think she could fly.
To combat the murderers who destroy my family, crush my own life on their way to consuming everything, I must become a greater, more fearsome destroyer.
Hey man, somebody killed this lady.
To track down the animals who prey on the innocent, I must stalk them first. I am no longer their quarry. I am the Huntress.
New Huntress podcast coming to you in 2019. Visit thehuntress89.blogspot.com for new episodes. Go to the Facebook page at Huntress Podcast. Go to Twitter, The Huntress Podcast. And you can always find episodes of The Huntress Podcast at rightonnetwork.com. And go to Apple iTunes, where this podcast is a joint venture with The Helena Bertinelli Podcast, and the Cassandra Cain Batgirl Podcast. So go to Apple Podcasts, the Batgirl/Huntress Podcast.
And we're back. Ms. Tree number 9. At a cover price of $1.75, meaning that when I saw this a number of years back, in the quarter bins of the Akron Comic-Con, that was at an 86% discount. The cover by Terry Beatty shows two detectives standing together, a dead body on the floor between them. The body has a noose around its neck. The detective on the left, the titular Ms. Tree, is talking to the other detective, and she says, "Well, missed, it'll take you more than a minute to solve this mystery." A brief explanation may be required here, as it would help to know that Mike Mist is a guest star in this issue. Mist was another detective creation of Max Allen Collins and Terry Beatty, appearing in one-page strips over the years. Because Mist had the ability to solve a crime in one page, something like 6 to 9 panels, these strips were called Minute Mysteries. So yes, Collins and Beatty love their puns, especially around the word mystery. Seeing as they have a character named Ms. Tree, and a separate project called Minute Mysteries, I can only imagine that their dream project was to team up these two characters with the DC character Mr. E. And as striking as the cover is, bright red background and a dead guy with a noose around his neck, I think if you don't get the reference, make the Mike Mist creator connection, this has to go over your head. And that category of people has to be the vast majority of potential readers. The story, Murder at Mohawk, is by the character's co-creators, the aforementioned Max Allen Collins and Terry Beatty. Although as I look carefully at this first page, I see that the writer is simply credited as Max Collins. No idea why anyone would ever drop the name Allen from their credits. I personally feel affronted. And continuing the team's use of the same pun, this is referred to as a Mist Tree tale, seeing as it will, in fact, team up this pair of detectives, Ms. Michael Tree and Mike Mist. It's probably worth mentioning that our lead character is a 6-foot-tall brunette lady named Ms. Michael Tree. She is the widow of a detective, also named Michael Tree, who died on their honeymoon, and during the aftermath, she took over his detective agency. Pretty convenient, as she didn't have to change the company's name. That story is chronicled over the first few issues of the title. It should also be noted that, despite this being an independent comic from the mid-80s, it is in fact in color. Now, the Ms. Tree title went through a number of publishers, and we'll talk about that later in the episode, and it was not always printed in color. But here at Eclipse, these issues were, in fact, in color. The story in issue 9 is broken into two parts. So for part 1 of Murder at Mohawk, we start with Ms. Tree's first-person narration. First-person narration is very common in PI prose stories, and Collins uses that technique throughout the run of Ms. Tree. I arrived at Mohawk Mountain House on a Thursday afternoon. The winter snow was falling gently, but a storm was on the way. One of my business associates, Roger Fremont, had recommended Mohawk, a resort hotel that had been around since the 1860s, tucked high away in the mountains upstate. This was off-season, and the place should be as restful as a monastery, but less crowded. So with that information on the first page to set the scene, we suspect that this is not going to be a restful vacation for our heroine. As a matter of fact, it is on the very next page, while she is signing the guest register, that she sees her colleague, Mike Mist. He wonders what a nice girl like her is doing in a mausoleum like this. They joke about trying their best to not go stumbling over any corpses, which you can probably guess is a little bit of foreshadowing. And just in case you weren't convinced that this story is from the 1980s, Mike Mist is not seen in any panel without a lit cigarette. Mist tries a little casual flirting, which from context, we understand is common between the two, as well as friendly and harmless. I miss that lughead husband of yours. He was the best PI in the business. Miss Tree does let Mist buy her a drink. We can insult each other better that way. At the bar, we learn why Mist is at Mohawk. He introduces Donna Lee Westlake, the mystery writer, and my client. It seems that the author is branching out into true crime. In fact, that's why I'm here, to research the Mohawk Massacre. Ms. Tree is unfamiliar with the supposedly famous crime. Ms. Westlake supplies the details. A latter-day Dillinger, known only as Carper, planned to knock over the bank in a town about 30 miles away with the help of three accomplices. His mistress, the ex-stripper Selma Devine, the driver Wheels, and the fearless gunman Babyface Block. Just so you know, Babyface looks just like Jameel's. The robbery seemed to be going well until one of the bank guards sneezed and was shot by Babyface.
He went for a gun, Carper. It wasn't my fault.
While Carper was yelling at Babyface for saying his name out loud, the 78-year-old Molly Earl's puppy barked. And let's just say that Babyface overreacted. In the getaway car, Carper was exasperated.
Great, Babyface. You killed an old man, an old lady, and a dog? We'll have every cop in the state on our butts, not to mention the Humane Society.
The plan was to hide pretty much under the police's noses. So the team split up into pairs, changing clothes and then checking in separately at the Mohawk. The next morning, when Selma the mistress woke up, she found that Carper was gone. And so was all the stolen money from the bank, which left the other three in the hotel as it is surrounded by police. Babyface killed 12 cops before his own death made it a baker's dozen. Selma and Wheels went to jail, life sentences, while Carper was never seen again, and neither was the half mil in cash. Westlake gestures to a nearby table, pointing out that Selma and Wheels are there. They had just been paroled after 30 years in the joint, and the author invited them, all expenses paid, for an interview. Turns out that Westlake invited another member of the original cast of the massacre, and they go up to the room of Elwood Epley, the night desk clerk, that night. They discover him inside, dead, his body hanging from a ceiling light fixture. End of part one. We then have 9 pages of content that we will discuss later in the episode. After that, part two begins right there. The author runs to get the managers of the place while the two detectives look around the room. They see a chair kicked over under the body and also note a fire burning in the fireplace. Mist wonders if that makes sense.
Did he want to be toasty warm before he snapped his own neck?
The lamp fixture gives way and the body falls into Mist's arms. They lay him out on the bed and Miss Tree notes that the back of his head has been caved in. Mist immediately deduces why the fire had been set and pulls out a piece of unburned wood from the fire, the murder weapon.
Look at the blood and hair.
They lay out the crime. Somebody killed him with this piece of firewood, then strung him up and faked the suicide, starting a fire to burn the murder weapon figuring that Elwood's weight would eventually pull the fixture loose. And then the blow on his head would be blamed on that fall. Now, heavy snow has moved into the area, meaning that nobody can leave the Mohawk. Now, it's off-season, so beside the two detectives, there are no guests in the place other than that original cast of characters from the Mohawk Massacre. Minus, of course, the recently deceased Elwood and the long-missing criminal mastermind Carper. Now, the original night of the massacre, these four were the only guests at the place as the hotel was under renovation. They were installing new fireplaces in each guest room. A couple of pages of investigating reveal that Selma was also sleeping with Wheels. And Carper caught them that night at the Mohawk. The two of them always assumed that Carper split with the money and called the cops on them. But the author Westlake does not agree. She has not found out much about Carper, except one thing. He was honorable. He lived by a code. Now, another thing happened that fateful night. Someone at the hotel shoved a note under Carper's door with letters cut out from magazines and newspapers. "Cut me in, or cops come calling. In touch." The married couple, who ran the hotel back then, and still run the hotel today, admit that they recognized Carper and sent the blackmail note. But when they sent a second note telling him where to leave the money, he didn't respond. Now, Elwood comes into the story here because Selma had called down for a bottle of rum from room service. Now, Ms. Tree has a hypothesis of what may have happened next. When he brought it up, Carper assumed he was the blackmailer and began to get rough. Elwood hit him with the bottle, killed him, and then stashed the body somewhere. With only a few pages left in the story, this means we still have a number of unanswered questions. Where is Carper's body? Where is all that cash? And in the current day, who just killed Elwood? And why? Now, Mike Mist has a theory about the body and the cash, and he has gotten hold of a pickaxe that is going to help him get his answers. Meanwhile, Ms. Tree and Donna Lee Westlake talk privately in the hallway. The author knows that the detectives have figured it all out. And Ms. Tree puts it to her plainly. "I think you set out to clear the legendary Carper's name. I think you're the honorable thief's daughter." You see, it was her description of Selma as his mistress that clued in the detectives. If so little was known about Carper, how could she have known that he was married, making Selma his mistress? It's because he was married to Westlake's mother and cheating on her with Selma. In the great tradition of noir PIs, Ms. Tree is willing to let all this go if the fake suicide gets past the police. Elwood didn't deserve to die. You killed him much as he killed your father, without premeditation. But you organized this weekend, so the police may look at it differently. And then as we move through the last page, Ms. Tree notes to Westlake that unless she misses her guess, it's time for a little family reunion. And in the last panel, we see what Mike Mist has been doing with the pickaxe and what he has discovered, which is a skeleton in a bag of cash sealed up in the wall by the fireplace. The end. Remember those 9 pages in the middle of the issue that we skipped over? What we have there are reprints of 9 one page, Mike Missed Minute Mysteries, all from 1979. By the way, in these stories, Mist looks and dresses an awful lot like Dick Tracy. To give you a feel for how those mysteries occurred and were resolved, one was based on the fact that a ransom note was received in the mail in a standard envelope, but the sheet itself was not folded over or creased. In another one, an actor in his dressing room was struck on the back of his head from behind, and Mist realized that the victim must have known his assailant because he would have seen him in the mirror that he was using as he removed his makeup. Another one was solved when a victim's husband responded to the news of his wife's death with, "Who did it?" suggesting that he had prior knowledge that it was in fact foul play and not a natural death. And another was more of a PSA almost about a fellow using fake collection boxes to steal UNICEF donations. But let's spend most of our analysis time on this first story. First, there are a couple of real-world references in this story. The fictional author Donna Lee Westlake is a reference to the real-life author Donald Westlake, to whom the story is dedicated. In 1983 and 1984, Westlake and his wife hosted the Mohonk Mystery Weekend at the Mohonk Mountain Lodge in upstate New York. Obviously, this is the inspiration for the setting of this story, as the Mohonk becomes the Mohawk, and I hope that I am enunciating those words clearly enough for you to note the subtle difference. The real Donald Westlake is probably best known for the books that he wrote under the name Richard Stark, novels featuring the character Parker. Parker novels have been made into multiple movies, and a series of graphic novels based on those works also exist. Westlake passed away in 2008. At one of those mystery weekends in the early 80s, Max Allen Collins attended as a special invited guest, and he was part of the cast that acted out one of the mysteries that the paying guests were then invited to solve. In that one, Collins's character was killed by hanging. All of this information is contained in a note from Collins on the letters page, which ends with this: "Whether this issue is my way of saying thanks to Donald Westlake or of getting even with him is a mystery even Ms. Tree and Mike Mist will never solve." So there you go. A little background. As far as that mystery in this issue goes, I think it worked. You did have a cool setting and a number of suspects, some twists and turns, surprise revelations, and a reasonable enough resolution. The Ms. Tree stories were never set up to present fair play mysteries like the Mays Agency did. But there were certainly enough clues in the issue to follow the detective's reasoning. It's actually one of the things that makes summarizing or synopsizing stories like this kind of tricky, because you need to mention things like the fireplaces and emphasize the word mistress, while not overemphasizing the important parts, making them too obvious. It's a fun balance to try to maintain, similar, I imagine, to the balance that the writer of a mystery has to maintain in laying out clues and dead ends and red herrings. Now, this issue does stand apart from the standard Ms. Tree issues in a couple of significant ways. Most of the other stories are not team-ups, for one thing. I don't believe that this issue was intended to be like a true backdoor pilot for a Mike Mist series, but it does kind of have that feel. The finding of the clues, the actual detection, was evenly split between our two leads. Perhaps even a little more of that was done by Mike Mist than by Ms. Tree. It was certainly a way for Collins and Beatty to get their other detective character in a long-form story in front of the eyes of readers of their other, more popular character. And I don't think this story fits the definition of a cozy mystery, but it is certainly much nearer to that characterization than Ms. Tree's issues usually are. For example, in this one, there is very little blood, if any, and she never once brandishes a handgun. There's no gunplay whatsoever, which is very unlike her. In many ways, this particular issue is far less of a hard case crime story, less of a traditional hard-boiled PI story, than her stories usually are. Also, there are a number of ongoing storylines and subplots in the Mystery Universe, and the fact that this does not include any of them actually makes this a very approachable issue, perhaps one of the more approachable issues in the entire run. We don't have anything about her ongoing dealings with her primary adversaries, the Muerta crime family. Like I just said, this issue had far fewer hails of bullets than her issues often have, because when you're going up against the mafia, sometimes gunfire just happens. Her co-workers at the agency and her son Michael Jr. both get name-checked in this issue, but none of that has any impact on the story. And I suppose, with absolutely no evidence, but I suppose this self-contained, disconnected story is placed here as a way of wrapping up the Eclipse Comics era of Ms. Tree. I even wonder if this was an inventory story, previously existing, written and produced beforehand, and then slotted into issue 9 because they were wrapping up their run with Eclipse and prepping to move the title. There's a note in the back of the issue where Collins is very gracious for the opportunity afforded them by Eclipse, and saying that they're sad to be moving on. But as is the case with many of the indie titles of this era, Ms. Tree bounced around among publishers. With only one missing month, issue 10 showed up at Aardvark Vanaheim, one of the very few non-Cerebus-related titles ever produced by that Canadian publisher. That relationship lasted for issues 10 through 15, after which it is co-published with Renegade for 3 more issues. Renegade Press then picked it up as the sole publisher after that, from issues 19 until the run wrapped up at issue 50. I specifically mentioned that this issue was full color, and from what I remember, confirmed by a little research, the Eclipse issues were the only ones in full color of this era, from this era of mystery. The remaining 41 issues were black and white, but there was a duo shade in each issue, maybe a red, but often a blue or a brown. Now, none of those later runs, the different publishers, none of those are reboots or restarts of the story. All of the plots and subplots carry forward throughout the entire run. So you can read the 50 issues and get a consistent character, consistent storylines, etc. At the time of this recording, just FYI, I own 43 of the 50 issues. The license for Ms. Tree now lies with Titan Comics, although there is no evidence that new stories featuring the detective are on their way. They are bringing out new reprint volumes of her adventures. The first 2 volumes cover material from her later stint at DC Comics, where 10 oversized issues of Ms. Tree Quarterly / Ms. Tree Special were published. I believe that beginning with Volume 3 of those Titan reprint volumes, these stories from the original run are appearing. And if you have the Hoopla digital app, those Titan reprints are available. Again, the only thing to keep in mind with those reprints is that the first two volumes actually are reprinting later material. So if you want to read her adventures in publication order, start with Volume 3. But I know, that only matters if you are a picky, nerdy, borderline OCD geek. Oh wait, never mind. That actually describes all of us. By the way, this is the third issue of Ms. Tree that we have covered on this podcast. Back in 2016, episode 76, Mark Sweeney and I talked about Ms. Tree Special, number 9, that is from that DC Comics run, which produced, as I said, 10 issues. Mark and I then covered issue 10, the final issue, on his I'm the Gun podcast. And then just 2 years ago, episode 182, I covered issue 1 of this run from Eclipse, back when the title had the longer name of Ms. Tree's Thrilling Detective Adventures. Those two earlier episodes of The Quarterbin can be found on this feed or on the Quarterbin Classics podcast feed. Unfortunately, I do not believe that the episode from Mark's podcast feed is currently available. Now, since that first episode back 8 years ago now, I have become quite the fan of Max Allan Collins. I've read a bunch of the prose novels in his Quarry series. And one very silly reason that I've become such a fan of his is that when we posted that episode, episode 76, Max Allan Collins actually commented on the blog post, and it was clear from his comments that he had listened to the episode. So he gets high marks from me on the nice guy creator scale. It is always possible that a positive interaction with a creator biases or blinds a reviewer, but I don't think that's what's happening here. But I give you all that info in the interest of full disclosure, as that fact may well be biasing my verdict. The verdict on Ms. Tree number 9. I really enjoy this character, and I thought that this was a very solid, fully contained one-off story. Based on that, I'm willing to say that Ms. Tree number 9 is a legit quarter bin deal. And that wraps up our coverage of Ms. Tree number 9, bringing episode 204 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close. Next time, I'll be participating in this year's version of the podcasting and blogging crossover event of the year, J.L. May. And this year, we are breaking all the rules, especially the one about it being in May. But don't think we're just monkeying around, although we are actually all going to be monkeying around, because for this year only, it's J.L. April, because it's all about the monkeys. And my contribution here on the Quarterbin Podcast will be to cover Kong on the Planet of the Apes number 1 from Boom Comics, cover dated November 2017. Sorry about that last part, Billy. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episode, PI Comics, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarter Bin.
The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
Music in this episode was Escape Velocity by Scott Buckley. His music can be found at soundcloud.com/Scott Buckley. I found the song at free-stock-music.com and am playing it here via Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.
Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.